Stafford. Mr. Schleppenbach.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to begin by addressing the District Court's erroneous jury instructions this morning. The District Court instructed the jury over Mr. Cruz's objection that in order to find for Mr. Cruz, the jury had to find that Mr. Cruz had a constitutionally protected right to be free from excessive force, and that Mr. Cruz had to prove the existence of that right. The Eighth Amendment gives Mr. Cruz the right to be free of excessive force. This Court has stated that as recently as Richmond v. Sheehan in 2008.
It also says it in Instruction 12.
Yes, and there are other instructions that do correctly state that the Eighth Amendment gives Mr. Cruz the right to be free of excessive force.
But it's Instruction 12 where this, we'll call it inadvertent or whatever, find is put in. You must find that the plaintiff had a constitutionally protected right. Find shouldn't be there, right?
It just says he has it
up there. I guess that's the problem here.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that this instruction is erroneous in essentially inviting the jury to decide for itself whether Mr. Cruz's Eighth Amendment right exists. And we believe that the jury in this case may have decided that he did not have an Eighth Amendment right to be free of excessive force. Although there are other places in the instructions that correctly say that the Eighth Amendment right to be free of excessive force exists, they don't in any way remove or explain or correct the instruction to the jury that it must find the existence of the right, and that, in fact, Mr. Cruz bears the burden of proving the existence of that right. And this Court has previously stated that in order to cure an erroneous jury instruction, a single erroneous instruction, the other instructions have to do more than just be correct in and of themselves. They have to somehow correct or explain the erroneous instruction. In fact, Supreme Court said that in Francis v. Franklin in 1985. This Court has also recognized that instructions like this instruction that shift the burden of proof are especially suspect. In this case, what the instruction did was state that Mr. Cruz had to prove something that, in fact, should have been presumed as a matter of law, the existence of this right. A similar case from this circuit is Davis v. Lane from 1987, where the Court found reversible error in a 1983 suit where the district court gave a legally erroneous instruction. The instruction in that case was a merged instruction for assault and battery and Section 1983 claims, and the court found that it didn't articulate correctly the burden of proof that the plaintiff had. The same thing happened here, Your Honors. This instruction articulates the burden of proof incorrectly. It gives Mr. Cruz something additional to prove that should not be his burden. And for that reason, this Court should similarly find an abuse of discretion in these instructions and reverse and remand. The error is not harmless, Your Honors. For one thing, the district court recognized that it had used this instruction before and that it thought the instruction was a correct statement of law. And this Court has additionally recognized that the gravity of instructional error is such that it will rarely be harmless. And that's from United States versus Perez in 1994. This case should certainly be no different. The instructional error in this case allocated Mr. Cruz a burden he should not have had to bear.
If I understand correctly the defendant's argument, it's that other instructions made it quite plain that the Eighth Amendment created this right. And so the question being posed for the jury is simply what happened. Why should we treat this instruction as countermanding the other instructions?
Your Honor, I believe that the jury had no guidance as to which instruction should countermand the other. The instructions conflicted. Neither instruction explained or corrected the other. So the jury was left without guidance as to which instruction correctly articulated what Mr. Cruz's burden of proof was. On the one hand, the jury could have decided to follow the instruction that stated that Mr. Cruz had an Eighth Amendment right to be free of excessive force. On the other, it could have chosen to follow the instruction that said they had to find whether he had that right or not. The jury simply didn't have enough instructions, as it were, from the instructions. And when a jury is left rudderless, as it were, that's exactly the sort of situation that calls for reversal because the law is not clear from the instructions given.
Hard to understand that Now, instruction one says there is such a right. Instruction two says you have to find that there is such a right, but the only basis for finding one way or the other on that question is instruction one. There's no hint in the brief that defense counsel was arguing to the jury that it should find that under the Eighth Amendment, prisoners are fair game for guards. Was there any such argument?
No, Your Honor.
Right. Well, then the only sensible way a jury responds to this is, instruction one tells us there's such a right, instruction two tells us you have to find there's such a right, but we've already been told there is. Now, I could imagine if the defense is trying to make some kind of, you should just say prisoners are beneath the law, and use this instruction and run with that, then you'd have a sound case. But if no one's making that argument, it's hard to see why this matters.
Your Honor, it matters because the juries were invited to reach that conclusion for themselves. The juries were invited to find the existence of the right, or the opposite of that, to find that it doesn't exist. And in fact, one of the prospective jurors was dismissed.
Suppose in a criminal case, the jury is told that one of the elements of the crime is you have to find that there's a law against bank robbery, right? And an earlier instruction had said bank robbery is illegal, and here's the statute. You wouldn't think that that instruction would matter, would you? Why is it any different here?
Your Honor, I would think that the instruction would matter because I think it runs the risk of confusing the jury as to what should be a relatively straightforward case. I think juries are presumed to follow their instructions, but only where those instructions are clear. If the jury isn't told exactly how to decide the case, it's hard to know exactly what happened in the jury room. Similarly, I would suggest that the district court erred in refusing to allow Mr. Cruz to amend his pro se complaint to conform to the evidence.
I must say, I'm very puzzled by your argument and your adversaries. I mean, both sides are treating complaints as if complaints plead law, and you had to plead law in a complaint. And we've held the opposite. Indeed, this was the fundamental decision made in 1938. Then one never has to amend a complaint. But if I understand what happened here, the question doesn't have to do with the complaint. The question has to do with what's in the pretrial order. The district judge said, I'm not going to allow assault and battery to be put in the pretrial order because I think the issue has been raised too late. And that's completely unrelated to amending the complaint. The judge always can say, I'm keeping an issue out of the pretrial order because it wasn't raised earlier. It wasn't raised on time. Why do you think it's an abuse of discretion for the judge to keep this issue out of the pretrial order?
Your Honor, I believe it's an abuse of discretion because the issue was always in the case from the beginning. Even Mr. Cruz's complaint, although filed pro se, clearly indicates a claim for assault and battery in addition to a Section 1983 claim. In fact, the complaint includes the word assault. It alleges that Mr. Cruz was assaulted by John Safford. So the claim for assault was always in the case, and for the district court to decide not to include it is an abuse of discretion. And if Your Honors have no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Ms. Barrow.
May it please the court. There was no abuse of discretion in proffering the jury instructions. The court accurately instructed the jury regarding...
It's a ridiculous jury instruction. Why should any judge tell the jury they have to decide what the law is? Judges decide what the law is, and they tell the jury what the law is. Whether there is a right protected by the Eighth Amendment not to be strangled by a guard is a question of law, and it's the judge's job to resolve the legal questions and tell the jury. I mean, why should any judge ever give an instruction like this?
At worst, that was simply unnecessary.
No, it may be unnecessary. It may be harmless. But you began by saying it was fine to give this instruction. It was not an abuse of discretion to give the instruction. And I can't imagine why a judge would tell the jury that the jury needs to figure out what the law provides.
That's not what the judge thought he was telling the jury. And even if it was an incorrect statement, I beg your pardon?
Who tendered the instruction?
This was an instruction that the court had used before. It was not one of
Was it tendered, or did he just whip it out on his own?
I believe it was he used his own instructions for excessive force. And what the
this
plaintiff...
This wasn't an instruction that said...
I beg your pardon?
This wasn't that kind of an instruction. This was an instruction what they had to figure out, that he was that the defendant was entitled, or the plaintiff was entitled to constitutional right.
The instruction, the particular instruction, actually had two parts. It started out explaining that the defendant or the plaintiff had a right under the Eighth Amendment to be free from excessive force.
Right.
And then the second part generally outlined Section 1983 law.
He had to find whether he had such a right.
And the what?
Am I correct in my analysis of what he said?
The taken as a whole, the what the jury had to decide was whether the facts showed that this right was violated.
Is that what the instruction said?
The one part of the instruction does say you find whether he had this constitutional right.
Right.
What the plaintiff is suggesting is that...
What I wanted to know is whether that instruction, as you've just described it, was tendered by any party to the proceeding, or did the judge simply whip it out and give it himself?
Right. I don't know.
Under normal circumstances, the lawyers tender the instructions.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to know whether this was an extra, and judges can, if they choose, pop in with their own right ideas on the subject. The question was that I raised was it tendered or was it sui sponte on the part of the judge?
I don't know for certain, except that he indicated he had used that instruction before. Whether it originated with defendants, I don't know.
That was when it was challenged, wasn't it? There was some question about this very thing, and he said he's used it before and it's okay or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah, so it wasn't inadvertent, really. It had something he knew and somebody didn't like, and he said he's going to use it anyway.
He said the juries had been able to sort it out. What the plaintiff is suggesting is that the jury was not able to find that he had this constitutional right and as a result ruled against him. And so if there was any error, it was harmless error. As far as amending the complaint is concerned, tendering an instruction on assault and battery, what the defendant said to Judge McKinney was, if we had had the opportunity to brief that issue, we would have raised certain defenses. Specifically, they're suing the wrong defendant. Under state law, you can only sue an individual state employee if you allege that he acted outside the scope of employment. But here it's just the opposite. They raised a Section 1983 claim where they allege that he acted under color of state law. So it was something the defendant did not have an opportunity to brief, and the judge could easily have determined that it would have been a waste of time in any event to submit this claim to the jury because by the third time that the counsel asked to submit this, it was after all the evidence had been heard, and the judge could well have determined in deciding whether to submit this instruction to the jury that the plaintiff simply had not proven those claims. And then the final issue was the limitation of cross-examination of Rick Shannon. The trial transcript shows that counsel was concerned about his memory. How could he remember 5 weeks after an incident what Cruz said to him if he couldn't remember at his own deposition how many times he'd been arrested? That was the discussion with the judge at the trial. On appeal, they're saying that the issue is actually one of credibility. The judge's concern was that if the jury hears about his arrests, that will be their concern. My goodness, this man's been arrested 8 times. And that any other consideration, such as credibility, would not be forefront in their minds. Again, this at most is harmless error because if the jury decides that Shannon is not credible, then they would look at what Cruz's version of the facts is. What Cruz said was that he told Shannon that that Safford attacked him, and what is Shannon going to do about it? And in light of all the other evidence, none of which supports the story that that Stafford reached into his cell and choked him, that if the jury disbelieved Shannon, solely only Shannon's testimony, that there would have been a different result in the trial, and at most it was harmless error. And if there were no other questions, I would ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barrow. Anything further, Mr. Schlevenbaum?
Just quickly, Your Honors. Counsel for Mr. Stafford suggests that the jurors could sort out the problems with the instructions, but that's not the function of jury instructions. The function of jury instructions is to instruct the jury on the law so that they don't have to sort the law out for themselves.
If you pored over this carefully enough, you know who tendered the instruction, or was it sui sponte on the part of the court?
My understanding is that it was sui sponte.
Okay.
That this was an instruction that the judge had used before and felt the jurors understood.
He liked it, so he was going to give it.
Yes, he wanted to use the instruction he was familiar with. In fact, Your Honors, evidence of the possibility of juror confusion on this issue is presented by something that happened during voir dire, where one of the prospective jurors was dismissed for saying that he had a hard time believing that prisoners had any rights. So perhaps it's especially troubling to invite the jury to decide for itself whether prisoners have an Eighth Amendment right.
Well, I thought that goes against your argument, because if the court threw him out, they must have some sort of a hint that is not appropriate decision to take.
The colloquy, that occurred outside of the presence of the jury, so the jury wasn't on warning that was bad behavior.
Weren't the jurors all present when the voir dire interrogation went on, or were they individually interrogated?
Actually, Your Honor, you're correct. There was part of that colloquy occurred off the record, but part of it did occur on the record, so the jurors were made aware of it. But I think that would make a juror even less likely to speak up regarding his conviction that defendants do not have rights.
You're assuming everybody wants to serve in a jury. My experience has been almost contrary.
Well, I knew, Your Honor. So in this case, there's evidence that there was a substantial possibility that the jury could have been confused by this instruction, which was not a correct statement of the law. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.